Well, brethren, I'm sure for all of us, when we think of, you know, the fulfillment of the Feast of Tabernacles in the millennium, you know, we think of a plush, beautiful earth and, you know, the earth being like, as a Garden of Eden and a land of plenty and, you know, plentiful crops and, you know, everything being in abundance. And as you know, I mean, for that to take place, there's a stark transition between that and what's going to take place during the Day of the Lord. Because, you know, during the Day of the Lord, we have just unprecedented devastation that is going to take place on the earth. And by the time that the Day of the Lord is finished, I mean, the earth is literally going to be in a state where it can barely sustain life. I mean, it's literally going to be very, very critical to the situation. And to make that transition, you know, from an earth that's just absolutely destroyed to this Garden of Eden, beautiful utopian setting, is going to require supernatural intervention, you know, for God to heal the earth and, you know, to make it into this new creation. So what we're going to do today is to look at this particular subject. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's New Heavens and New Earth. Again, New Heavens and New Earth. Now, if you've been in the Church of God for many years, I know myself, I've been in the church since birth, you probably remember a time where oftentimes we thought of the terms of New Heaven and New Earth, you know, not as a millennial thing, you know, but it's something that happened after, you know, there was no more physical human beings. But what we're going to see today is, again, that doesn't really fit the context where a lot of these scriptures are mentioned. You know, and as a result of the fact that we had that kind of a view, oftentimes, I know I grew up in the, you know, in the church, hearing sermons at the feast oftentimes with lots of speculation about how this destroyed earth was going to be, you know, kind of repaired by human beings. We're all going to have these work crews and other things that they're doing to try to clean this up. And we had that. I mean, again, that was well-intentioned to say, but I'm not trying to pick on anyone that was talking about that at the time, because I believed that growing up as a kid too. But if we understand the magnitude of the devastation that will take place during the Day of the Lord, that's just not, it's not a logical picture. Because the devastation is going to be so severe, it will absolutely require supernatural intervention from God, you know, to turn this around and to make the earth not only inhabitable, but again, to be this beautiful Garden of Eden scene, you know. And I think sometimes we have trouble wrapping our minds around the severity of the devastation that will take place with the Day of the Lord. And the reason being is, you know, oftentimes, you know, we think of disasters in our context, you know, natural disasters that we see about on the news, and they're always of a regional nature. Because if you think about it, you know, if a hurricane hits a particular area or a tornado tears something up or an earthquake or, you know, wildfire comes through an area, you know, we see the footage and we see this severe devastation, but we know that's limited to a geographical region. You know, it happened in that particular area. It didn't happen everywhere. It just hurt a particular area. And that's how our minds tend to think of it. And we have to realize, we have to get outside of that type of mindset to be able to realize the severity of the devastation. So let's first of all turn over to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. And we'll see this addresses this subject, but it also addresses the normal human tendency to think that, well, things will always fit into the context of which, you know, that we relate to, of how our minds tend to conceptualize things. You know, and that's sometimes our difficulty in understanding all of this. It's 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. It said, "Beloved, I now write to you this second epistle, both in which I stir up your pure minds by way of reminder, that you may be mindful of the words which are spoken before by the holy prophets, and of the commandment of us and the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts, and saying, 'Where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation.'" In other words, things always stay within the realm of what I understand and what I've seen. "For this they will willfully forget, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth which now exist are kept in store by the same word, reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." Now this is a reference to the day of the Lord. And skip down to verse 10. "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought we to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. And again, you can see that it's making a very dire prediction here. But again, oftentimes we have some trouble wrapping our mind around the magnitude and the extent of this devastation that's going to take place. So again, to set the context of this sermon, to kind of see, again, the need for a supernatural healing, we first need to kind of get a concept of the severity of the devastation that will take place during the day of the Lord. So let's just briefly review that. Turn over to Revelation chapter 8. We're not going to go through the entire day of the Lord and everything that happens, but what I want to do is to cover some of the main points that illustrate for us the severity of the devastation that will take place on the earth because of the plagues of the day of the Lord. So again, Revelation chapter 8 and verse 7. And the first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. And then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. And then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. And the name of the star is Wormwood, and a third of the waters became wormwood, and many of them died, and the water became, as it was, very bitter. And then the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so a third of them darkened, and a third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. Now notice we have a lot of severe plagues here, but notice one of the big things is that it's attacking both salt and fresh water. And we're going to see here in a minute when we turn to chapter 16, we get to the point that all of the water is blood, in both your fresh and salt water. Now, you think about that, that's going to kill all marine life. You know, they can't live in that. You know, it's going to wipe out, knocking out the plankton in the ocean, which is, again, about 50% of the oxygen supply for the planet. You know, and just think of how much, you know, of the greenery, I mean, not only animals, but plants and everything, depend upon hydration and depend upon water. Turn it all to blood and think about how much global devastation you're going to have. So turn over to Revelation 16. And we'll see this where it goes from one third to being everything. It's Revelation 16 and verse 3. Then the second angel poured out his bowl on the sea, and it became blood as a dead man, and every living creature in the sea died. And notice we've gone from one third of the sea now to all of it. You know, so this is going to wipe out, as it mentions, all of marine life. But even more than that, if you think about the oxygen supply for the planet, approximately about half of it comes from plankton in the ocean. The other half comes from, you know, trees and other, you know, green plants and such that take in carbon dioxide and put out oxygen. But if you wipe out everything that lives in the sea, you just wiped out half the oxygen supply for the planet is what you've done. I mean, just think of the devastation this would take place here. And then in verse 4, then the third angel poured out his bowl on the rivers and the springs of water, and they became blood. See, now we're wiping out all the fresh water. And I heard the angel of the water saying, "You are righteous, O Lord, the one who is and who was and who is to be, because you have judged these things. For you have shed the blood of the saints and the prophets, and you have given them blood to drink, for it is their just due." And I heard another in the altar saying, "Even so, Lord Almighty, true and righteous are your judgments." In verse 8, and then the fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and the power was given to him to scorch men with fire. And the men were scorched with great heat, and they blasphemed the name of God who has power over these plagues, and they did not repent or give him glory. Now skip down to verse 17. Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came from the temple of heaven and from the throne, saying, "It is done." And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, with such a mighty great earthquake as had not been occurred since men were on the earth. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities and the nations fell. And great Babylon was remembered before God to give up her cup of wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. And a great hail in heaven fell upon men, and every hailstorm about the weight of a talent. And men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. As you can see here, we've got massive devastation that it's quite frankly hard for us to wrap our minds around. Because again, when we think of, you know, a wildfire or a hurricane or something, you know, that destroys an area, we may be, you know, just awed by the footage we see on the news, but we know in our mind, again, that's limited to a region. You know, we don't think of these things as happening to the entire planet, you know, and it's affecting everyone everywhere. But that's exactly what's going to take place here. And we can see all of this summed up in Jeremiah chapter 4. It's in Jeremiah chapter 4. What we're going to see here is it describes the earth after the day of the Lord, basically using the exact same Hebrew terminology. It describes the earth after Satan's rebellion. You know, when God had to do recreation of the earth just being so destroyed it was without form and void. Well, that's exactly what's going to be the state after the day of the Lord. It's Jeremiah 4, verse 23. "I beheld the earth, and indeed it was without form and void." Again, that's tohu and bohu. That was the exact same Hebrew terminology you'll find in Genesis 1. "And the heavens, they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and indeed they trembled, and the hills moved back and forth. And I beheld, and indeed there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens that fled. I beheld, and indeed the fruitful land was a wilderness, and all the cities were broken down from the presence of Jehovah by his fierce anger. For thus says Jehovah, the whole land shall be desolate, yet I will not make a full end. For this shall the earth mourn, and the heavens be black, because I have spoken, and I have poured out, and I proposed, and it will not relent, nor will I turn back from it." In other words, this is a result of the day of his wrath, you know, of all the plagues that he pours out upon mankind, you know, and upon the earth. It will be just absolutely, totally destroyed. So, and again, notice over in Isaiah 24, notice a similar description here. Isaiah 24, we'll start in verse 1. "Behold, Jehovah makes the earth empty and makes it waste, distorts its surface and scatters abroad its inhabitants." Now drop down to verse 6. "Therefore the curse has devoured the earth, and those who dwell in it are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left." See, clearly we're talking about the day of the Lord and all the devastation that will take place. Now, again, as I mentioned, if you're like me, you know, I grew up in the church. My parents were baptized, you know, before I was born. You know, so all of my childhood, I grew up, you know, attending the feast. And numerous times, you know, in those years, I heard sermons that basically painted the picture that, you know, after the day of the Lord, will, you know, God will be, you know, kind of, you know, mobilizing the troops of all the humans, and they'll go out and plant trees, and they'll be, you know, doing all these efforts to try to clean this up. When you understand the magnitude of the, you know, the devastation that's going to take place, that's just not realistic. You know, it's not something that mankind can go fix, you know, through physical effort. This is going to require supernatural intervention. Because, I mean, realistically, the earth is not going to be in any shape to be sustaining human life, you know, for any length of time without God intervening and supernaturally healing it. If we turn over to Ezekiel chapter 47, we can get a picture of how God plans to address this problem. See Ezekiel chapter 47, and we'll start reading in verse 1. Now, what we have here is a description of healing waters that come out from the temple there in Jerusalem. As you can see, as it's described, these waters go out and, you know, in two directions here, and as these flow and, you know, the rivers connect with trees, or they make their way to the ocean. Everywhere they go, they heal the land, you know, because it's a supernatural healing that takes place. This is Ezekiel 47 and verse 1. And then he brought me back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the thresholds of the temple towards the east, and from the front of the temple towards that faced the east, and the water flowing from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. And he brought out by the way of the north gate and led me around on the outside of the outer gate that faces east, and there was water running out on the right side. And then when a man went out to the east with a line in his hand, and he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the waters, and the water came up to my ankles. And he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters, and the water came up to my knees. And again he measured 1,000 and brought me through, and the water came up to my waist. And then he measured 1,000, and it was a river, and I could not cross, and the water was too deep, and the water in which one must swim, a river that could not be crossed. And he said to me, Son of man, have you seen this? And then he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river. And when I returned, there along the bank of the river was very many trees on one side and the other. And he said to me, this water flows towards the east region and goes down into the valley and enters the sea. And there it reaches the sea, and the waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves, wherever the rivers go, will live. And there will be a very great multitude of fish because the waters go there. And for they will be healed, and everything will live wherever the river goes. And it shall be that fishermen will stand by it from Engedi to in England, and they will be places for spreading their nets. And their fish will be of the same kinds as the fish of the great sea, exceedingly many. But its swamps and marshes will not be healed, and they will be given over to salt. Along the bank of the river, on the side, on this side and that, they will all be all kinds of trees used for food, and their leaves will not wither, and their fruit will not fail, and they will bear fruit every month, because their water flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for medicine. Now, the same river is mentioned again in Zechariah chapter 14. I'll turn over to Zechariah chapter 14. In verse 8. And in that day it shall be that living waters shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and half of them towards the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur. So as you can see, God's going to basically set this up where these healing waters, you know, start flowing out, and as they start to circle the earth, and, you know, and the rivers go into the oceans and such, everywhere it goes, it magically heals, you know, and supernaturally heals the land. And this is what it enables, this transition from this completely destroyed earth, you know, that is without form and void and can, you know, barely sustain life, you know, to this beautiful Garden of Eden setting that we see in so many of the millennial prophecies. Because as we can see, the way that this is described, you know, particularly in the book of Isaiah, is as a new creation. You know, this is something new that God has created, because you're going to see he doesn't just restore the earth back to what we experience today. He turns it into a Garden of Eden, you know, setting where the deserts bloom and the cypress trees are, you know, that require lots of water are growing in what used to be deserts. So let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 41. We'll see in verse 17. When the poor and needy seek water, there is none, and their tongues shall fail for thirst, I, Jehovah, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in desolate heights and fountains in the midst of valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. And I will plant in the wilderness the cedar and the acacia trees, the myrtle and the oil tree. And I will set in the desert the cypress tree and the pine and the box tree together. And you may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of Jehovah has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. Notice he makes it clear this is something he supernaturally does. You know, he's making a new creation with this. And again, we can just look at the description. And again, we don't have cypress trees growing in the desert today. Cypress trees need lots of water. Deserts are dry. You know, so it's not a matter of trying to restore things back to where they were. He's making a beautiful Garden of Eden setting of the earth, you know, something we haven't seen before. As we're going to see here, I mean, this is a new earth. You know, we'll see it here later when we look at the context of the scriptures that talk about new heaven, new earth. It's referring to a millennial setting. But when we understand it's a new creation, you know, it's something that we have not seen before of the earth being in this type of setting. You know, then you realize this truly is a new earth. You know, this is something he has, you know, recreated and made totally new. So turn over to Isaiah 43. We'll notice several references in this regard. It's Isaiah 43. Verse 18. Do not remember the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I will do a new thing. Now it shall spring forth, shall you not know it? I will even make a road in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. A beast of the field will honor me, and the jackals and the ostriches, because I give waters in the wilderness and rivers in the desert to give drink to my people, my chosen. This people I have formed for myself, and they shall declare my praise. Notice he says he's doing a new thing. Again, this is a new earth because, again, this description doesn't match anything, you know, that we've experienced in our time. This isn't a restoration of, you know, from the devastation just kind of back to where we were. This is a new earth. You know, this is a beautiful Garden of Eden setting that's probably kind of beyond our comprehension. So also turn over to Isaiah 51 and verse 3. For Jehovah will comfort Zion, and he will comfort all the waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of Jehovah. Their joy and gladness will be found in it, and thanksgiving in the voice of melody. Again, we just have this wonderful utopian setting here, this Garden of Eden, and you can see now with the earth being in this state, you know, how you would have this description of the earth is like a Garden of Eden. It also makes sense then when you think about resurrecting all the people that have lived, you know, throughout all mankind, you got a huge population you got to feed, don't you? You know, so if you think about that, if you're going to make all these areas fertile, you know, that's how you're going to have a food supply, you know, to be able to deal with all these people and how you'll have abundance. You know, because today we have big areas like, you know, the Sahara Desert and other things where you have, you know, these big areas where you know, it's not usable land, you know, to sustain people. Well, if you're turning all the deserts into areas where cypress trees can grow and, you know, there's just lots of, you know, green and lots of water everywhere, well, now you have a lot of usable land that you didn't have before. You know, so you basically reformed all of this, not only to make a beautiful utopian setting, but for the practical needs of what you're going to have bringing back all these people that you want to work with at this time. You can see it. Sometimes I like to joke when I look at things like this, that I'll kind of sarcastically go, you know, it's almost like some great master planner designed it that way. You know, and if you look at this, it's like, you know, it's like someone who really thought all this through and thought of all the details, you know, brought all this together because he planned it all from the beginning, before he even got started. Well, brother, as I mentioned, if you're like myself, if you grew up in the Church of God or you've been in for many decades, you probably oftentimes heard, you know, associated the phrase new heavens and new earth, not with the millennium. Not with, you know, a setting where there would be physical human beings. You associate that, that's beyond mankind. That's, you know, that's when it's all over. Well, as we're going to notice, if we go through all the scriptures, you know, that make this reference, you're going to see in a lot of the context, it's just very obvious we're talking about a setting with physical human beings on a physical planet. I mean, we'll see that's very clear. There's really only one scripture that can get confusing in that regard, and then we're going to look at that one in detail. But let's first of all turn over back over to 2 Peter, where we were just a minute ago. 2 Peter chapter 3. We're going to start back at verse 10. We read this before, but I want to read through this context until we get to the reference of new heavens and new earth here. It says, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day, but because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat." Now, notice, as we covered before, this is an obvious reference to the day of the Lord. You know, and this is referring to, again, to all the devastation that we read through in the book of Revelation, that will take place there. But now notice the next verse. "Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells." Now notice the chain of events here. I mean, because you have listed all the issues of, that are going to happen during the day of the Lord, the devastation that takes place, and the very next thing you have referenced is looking beyond that, and it mentions new heaven, new earth. Oftentimes that gets associated with, a time when there are no human beings. But if we look at the references to this particular phrase in the book of Isaiah, it becomes very clear that we have to be talking about a time when there's physical human beings. Because again, the references and the context are going to make that very obvious. So let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 66 and verse 15. "For behold, Jehovah will come with fire and with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword, Jehovah will judge all flesh, and the slain of Jehovah shall be many." And notice we're obviously talking about the day of his wrath. We're obviously talking about the day of the Lord context here. But let's just keep following the context here. "Those who sanctify themselves and purify themselves to go to the gardens after an idol in the midst of eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouse shall be consumed together, says Jehovah. For I know your works in their thoughts, and it shall be that I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. And I will set a sign among them, and those among them who escape, I will send it to the nations, to Tarshish and to Pul and to Lud and to draw the bow, and Tubal and Javan, and in the coastlands afar off, who have not heard my fame nor seen my glory. And they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. And then they shall bring all your brethren for an offering to Jehovah out of the nations, and the horses and the chariots and in the litters and mules and the camels to my holy mountain, Jerusalem, says Jehovah. As the children of Israel bring an offering in a clean vessel to the house of Jehovah. And I will also to take some of them for priests and Levites, says Jehovah." Now notice the next two verses. "For as the new heavens and new earth, I shall remain before me, says Jehovah. So shall your descendants in your name remain. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come to worship before me, says Jehovah." And notice he's talking about flesh coming before him. Now, first of all, notice we got the word flesh in there. So we're obviously talking about physical human beings. And he says from new moon to new moon and from Sabbath to Sabbath, they'll come before him to worship. Now, if we just understand the context and what this reference is, it's very obvious that we're referring to a millennial time frame. Because why would he be referring to them coming before him to worship from Sabbath to Sabbath and from new moon to new moon? Which I'm sure you're probably familiar with, there's lots of scriptures in the Bible that make it very clear that during the millennium, the sacrificial system, is going to be practiced. There's going to be a physical temple, there'll be a physical priesthood, you see the sacrifices, the grain offerings, all of that is described in quite graphic detail. You know, and we also know that, you know, God the Father is going to be, you know, he's going to return with Christ as well to the earth, and he's going to be dwelling in this physical temple, you know, in the most holy place, you know, behind the veil, just like he did with ancient Israel. You know, and what was the practice? Well, when you sacrificed, you came to the temple, you came before him to sacrifice there. Well, if you turn over to Numbers 28, we'll see the reference here to understand the context. And we can see we're obviously talking about a time with physical human beings. We'll turn over to Numbers 28. Numbers 28 and 29 describe basically all the details of the sacrificial system. I covered some of this a few days ago when I spoke. Was covering, you know, specifically the sacrifices that took place during the, you know, the Feast of Tabernacles, and I focused on the number of bulls and the descending number of bulls as you go forward in the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. But if you go through again all of these, you know, both of these chapters in detail, which we're not going to take the time to do today, what you're going to see, and if you've got a New King James translation of the Bible, you can kind of easily see this because they have the subheadings, you know, entered into the text. But, you know, it starts off with the daily offerings, you have the Sabbath offerings, and it says monthly offerings, but these are on the day of the new moons, you know, and then you go through all the holy days, and it starts with Passover, and it, you know, takes you all the way through the eighth day and all the sacrifices that were done. But again, remember how the sacrificing was done. You had to sacrifice at the temple. You had to go where God dwelt, you know, and bring your sacrifice there before him. You know, because that was one of the rules that was instituted after they had, you know, the tabernacle and then later the temple. You couldn't just sacrifice anywhere. You had to do it there at the temple. Well, notice here in verse 9, this is under the heading Sabbath offerings. And on the Sabbath day, two lambs in their first year without blemish, 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour as a grain offering mixed with oil and its drink offering, and this is the burnt offering for every Sabbath besides the regular burnt offering with its drink offering. So this is why he says, you know, from Sabbath to Sabbath, they'll come before me, you know, before his presence to worship. But notice he also says from new moon to new moon. Now notice the next verse in verse 11. At the beginning of your months, you shall present a burnt offering to Jehovah. Now, I'm going to skip over all the details in the next couple of verses because I don't want to get bogged down in all the details of all the specific sacrifices. But I want you to know, as he mentions, you know, at the beginning of your months, they had to come to sacrifice then as well. Well, that's the day of the new moon. So how do we know that? Turn over to just the next chapter, Numbers 29. In verse 1, this is referring to the offerings that were done on the Feast of Trumpets. And in verse 1, and in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a holy convocation, and you shall do no customary work, for you it is a day of blowing of trumpets. So we know we're specifically talking about the Feast of Trumpets, and when is trumpets? Well, it's the first day of the seventh month. It's the beginning of the month. So look down in verse 6, because again, we're skipping down into all the offerings that were commanded to be done that day. But in verse 6, it says, besides the burnt offering with its grain offering for the new moon. In other words, they had to do, in addition to, you know, the offering specific to, you know, to trumpets itself, because it was in a day of the new moon, it was the first day of the month. That's the biblical definition of the first day of the month. It's the day of the new moon. That's what, you know, well, what they had to do that day as well. So see, when you read the reference then in Isaiah 66, and he says, they're going to be coming before me from new moon to new moon and from Sabbath to Sabbath, what's he talking about? Physical human beings who are bringing their sacrifices to the temple where God dwelt to sacrifice him on those days to fulfill these commandments. So obviously when he says this is in the context of new heaven and new earth, he's got to be talking about the millennium. You know, there's no other way to interpret that, because we're talking about physical human beings doing physical sacrifices at a physical temple. We're obviously referring to new heaven and new earth has to refer to the replenished earth, you know, that would take place during the millennium. So now turn back over to Isaiah 65 this time. We'll see another similar reference. And again, the context is going to help us out here. Isaiah 65, and we'll start in verse 17. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be reminded, nor remembered, or come to mind. But now just pay attention to the context that's described after we've just said this is new heaven and new earth. Verse 18, but be glad and rejoice forever for what I create, for behold, I create Jerusalem as a rejoicing, and her people a joy, and I will rejoice in Jerusalem, a joy in my people, a voice of weeping shall no longer be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. No more shall an infant from there live but a few days, nor an old man who has not fulfilled his days. For a child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. This we're referring to physical lifespans. Verse 21, and they shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. And they shall build in another, they shall not build in another inhabit, and then they shall not plant in another eat. And for as the days of a tree, so shall be the days of my people. And my elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. And they shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth children for trouble. For they shall be the descendants of the blessed of Jehovah, and their offspring. And it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer. And while they are still speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox. And the dust shall be the serpent's food. And they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, says Jehovah. Now, notice the description here. We talked about lifespans of people. We're planting vineyards, building houses, you know, and we're talking about children. We obviously have a context here of physical human beings. The only conclusion we can come to is that new heaven and new earth has to be referring to the replenished earth, you know, that will take place during the millennium. You know, the newly created earth, as I covered here before, that, you know, is unlike anything that, you know, we have seen, you know, previously. Why it would be called a new earth, because it's something totally new than what's been experienced in the past. You know, but obviously we're talking a context of physical human beings here. So this has got to be in a millennial context. Now there's one other verse here that mentions this that oftentimes kind of confuses the subject. Turn over to Revelation chapter 21. We're going to kind of take a little time analyzing these particular verses here. Because what I'm going to suggest to you today is that these verses, this reference here, is the exact same matching all of the other references on New Heaven and New Earth here. Now, if you're like myself growing up in the church, you've probably seen two perspectives here, and I'll totally admit I've been guilty of both of them, you know, throughout my lifetime. One was taking the reference here in Revelation 21, and assuming this has to be, you know, referring to a time beyond human beings when there are no other human beings, and then you try to get all the other references in Isaiah and in Peter to match that. Well, you got to do some severe mental gymnastics to get that to work, you know. But because as we just went through, the context in Isaiah is very clearly talking about physical human beings. The other perspective of it is you basically look at the Isaiah references in 2 Peter and go, okay, well, this is obviously referring to the replenished earth after the day of the Lord. But then you go, well, Revelation 21, that's something different. You know, this is a totally, when we try to separate that reference out. And there's two reasons why we do that. They're found in the first four verses here in Revelation 21. And we're going to take a little time kind of dissecting this, again, because I think if we analyze it in detail, we can see this scripture matches all of the others, and the reference is consistent throughout the Bible. In Revelation 21, in verse 1, and I saw a new heaven and new earth. So again, we have this new heaven and new earth reference. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Now, that's typically one of the first problems. Then to keep reading, then I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, adorned as a bride for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, and there shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Now, what normally happens is the logic kind of goes like this. And again, I'll absolutely plead guilty. There are sermons on the website of me, you know, is just saying some of the things I'm about to correct today. You know, but we assume two things. We assume no more sea. Well, that obviously no more bodies of water is how we assume that. We think, okay, well, there's no more bodies of water. We must not be talking about a physical planet here. Then we take verse 4 and go, okay, well, we're obviously not talking about a time when there could be any physical human beings. You know, so again, we assume this has got to be, again, no water, and we're beyond, you know, all of mankind being made God beings. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. Because if you read through Revelation 21 and 22, what you'll see, and again, I'll cover some of this today in detail, is you got kind of two concepts going on here. Obviously, New Jerusalem is a spiritual concept. Is, you know, it describes this as the bride. You've got, you know, because that's dwelling together with you know, the Father and the Son. Because you'll even see in Revelation 21 where John has the vision. He says, "I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife." And what does he show him? He shows him the city. You know, so we're obviously talking about a spiritual concept here. But you're also going to see references to physical human beings in these chapters as well. You've got two concepts going on here. Because what happens at the beginning of the millennium? You know, well, Christ and the Father are going to come down to earth. We've all known that for some time. And we know, what are the jobs of the first fruits? Well, the first fruits are to work with all of mankind as well. Well, what are the first fruits composed of at that time? They're spirit beings. They've been resurrected to eternal life. So you've got all of these, you know, you've got the Father, you've got the Son, you've got all the first fruits who are all, again, spirit beings, a spiritual concept, who are what? On a physical earth, working with physical human beings. So you've got two things going on here. And one of the mistakes we oftentimes make is we try to make this, again, either totally spiritual or totally physical, and you got to do mental gymnastics to get either one of those to work. If you understand you've got two concepts going on in these chapters, it makes it easier. And let me start with kind of showing one of the things that first kind of opened my eyes on this subject. Look at verse 3. "And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God.'" Notice it says it's men, you know, and I have to say, much of my life I often looked at that and said, well, it's really referring to, you know, former men, you know, who are now God beings. And I made that argument for years. The problem being is that's not what the Greek word means. Let me read to you the definition of the Greek word translated there in the English word men. It's transliterated into English as anthropos. It's anthropos. You can tell I'm not an expert in Greek. It's Strong's number 444. And according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament by Spyros Zahaitis, here's how it's defined. Now, I'm not going to read you everything Zahaitis writes up on this, but I'm going to give you a synopsis of this. Quote, "Man, a generic name in distinction from gods and the animals. In the New Testament, used to make the distinction between sinful man whose conduct, way, or nature is opposed to God, a man or woman, an individual of the human race, a person. Spoken in reference to his human nature, a man, i.e. a human being, a mortal. Here is included the idea of human infirmity and imperfection, especially when spoken in contrast to God and divine beings." See, it's rather obvious by the definition, it's referring to physical men. Now, I can tell you, when I first became aware of this concept, you know, I was a hard sell, you know, so I looked at this and I thought, well, maybe there's other references in the Bible, you know, where maybe John uses this in a figurative means, you know, where he's referring to physical men and they're now spirit beings. So I searched for such a reference. I looked up every time that word was used. I went through all of John's writings in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John and in Revelation. There is not a reference where he uses it that way. You know, he has the perfect opportunity in Revelation 7 and in Revelation 14, because in both chapters, you know, he's talking, you know, he's looking forward into the future, where, you know, it's physical human beings who've been born into the kingdom of God, and he never uses the term like that to describe them. So when it says the tabernacle of God is with men, it's referring to physical men. Now, if we look at it like that, we realize then we've got two concepts going on here. Because yes, New Jerusalem is a spiritual concept. You know, this is the bride and, you know, and the Father and the Son together. But again, what are they doing during the millennium? They're working with physical humans. Now let's look at this reference of no more sea. You know, let's again just read verse 1. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Now again, if we take that to be an absolute literal reference, we would have to conclude that means no more bodies of water. Now we know during the millennium there's bodies of water. We just read about, you know, the river that flows into the oceans, and then there's bodies of water. But let's also consider something else. We're reading in the book of Revelation, aren't we? This is a book full of symbolic language. There's nothing unusual about the book of Revelation, you know, stating things in very symbolic language and not necessarily meaning those terms, again, literally how we might take the English words, you know, but creating a symbolic picture. So let's consider something else. What else might no more sea be a reference to that's not really referring to no more bodies of water? Because consider something else. What else do we know happens before the millennium starts? Well, it's pictured in the Day of Atonement. It's the Azazel goat. It's the binding of Satan. We know Satan is out of the picture. But now let's notice something interesting. How is Satan pictured in the Old Testament? He's pictured as a sea monster. He's pictured as a monster whose domain is the sea. And the beast power, which we know he is the power behind, you know, this is the physical empires that he works through, what are they pictured as? Coming up out of the sea. It's a very consistent reference. Turn over to the book of Job, chapter 41. Job chapter 41, we'll start in verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook, or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose, or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you, and will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will you apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons, or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him, remember the battle, never do it again. Now this is God talking to Job here, you know, but he is, you know, referring, using the picture of Leviathan, referring to Satan. And he's basically, you know, teaching the lesson to Job. I've taken Satan as my servant. You know, I got a hook in his nose. He does my bidding for him. I can control him. I got him like a dog on a leash. But you don't want to mess with him. He'll eat your lunch. You know, you don't want to take on this guy, but he's nothing to me. And to understand that this is exactly what he's referring to, just jump down to verse 33. This is, again, continuing to refer to Leviathan. On earth there is nothing like him, which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is the king over all the children of pride. Obviously, a sea monster, a literal, you know, sea monster that you would hook with a hook, is not the king over all the children of the pride, is he? You know, that's Satan. But again, the imagery here is he's a sea monster. And let's notice that this is numerous times throughout the Old Testament, and it refers to his domain as the sea. Turn over to Isaiah 27 in verse 1. In that day, Jehovah with his severe sword, great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Leviathan, that twisted serpent, and he will slay that reptile that is in the sea. Notice Satan's domain is referred to as being in the sea. And again, we're not going to read every scripture that mentions this, because if you do a search on the term Leviathan, you'll see a number of scriptures here we won't have time to cover today. But just to notice one more, turn over to Psalms 104 and verse 24. O Jehovah, how manifold are your works! In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. This great and wide sea, in which are innumerable teeming things, living things both small and great. There the ships to sail about, and there is that Leviathan which you have made to play there. In other words, the area where Leviathan, we know as Satan, plays, it's referred to as the sea. And notice also, if we look at the beast empires, because as we know, I mean, Revelation tells us Satan is the power behind the beast. You know, he gives them their power. They're able to do what they do because of his influence behind them. But notice how they're pictured. They're always pictured as rising out of the sea. Turn to Daniel chapter 7 and verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and the visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. And Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Notice what he's about to see is coming out of the sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was a lion and had eagle's wings, and I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, again, the chapter goes on in describing that in detail. I don't want to get lost in all those details, but just notice he's seeing the beast here. As we know, these were successive empires, you know, that would rule the area there. You know, and we won't get into all of that. I just want you to notice, how are they pictured? As monsters coming out of the sea. Now turn over to Revelation chapter 13. We'll see the same thing. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. Again, notice the beast comes out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and in his heads a blasphemous name. Again, and once again, we're not going to go through all the details that are described here with the beast, but again, just notice, again, you have Satan described as Leviathan, as a sea monster. We know he's not literally a sea monster. It's a symbolic picture. You know, but again, that's the picture he's associated with, and his domain, the place where he plays, is what? The sea. And the empires that he's the power behind that do his evil bidding for him, what are they pictured as? Coming up out of the sea. Now again, we know all of this is symbolic. You know, it's not literally tied to oceans. It's all a symbolism picture. But you can see how the Bible uses the picture of the sea. Now think of that in terms of Revelation 21. If you're talking about the beginning of the millennium, and you have now the resurrected saints, and if all of a sudden, you know, coming down to the earth, they're going to work with mankind, and you have a new heaven, new earth, which begins, we saw in Isaiah, that's how the millennial earth is described, it's new heaven, new earth, and you also say, and there's no more sea. Well, if Satan's been bound, that would apply, wouldn't it? No more sea, because you don't have Satan's influence anymore. Now let's look at one other verse here. Turn over to back over to Revelation 21. Another verse here that kind of can be a tripping up issue here is verse 4. I'm going to suggest a couple of ways we might look at this, and again, notice an interesting parallel here. It says, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, and there shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Again, we normally read this, I know I myself always have as well, as assuming, okay, we're talking about a time here where there's no more physical human beings. Now, again, I'm not going to give you a dogmatic interpretation of this particular verse. I'm going to suggest that there's, you know, possibly two ways to look at this. One is a forward-looking statement of that this is, you know, God's coming down to work with mankind, and the ultimate goal is, again, all being spiritual. But there's another possible way to look at this as well. Because as we noticed before, there are multiple verses, you know, particularly in Isaiah, that refer to new heaven and new earth. And what I want you to consider is how similar the layout of the statements made here in Revelation 21 directly match Isaiah 65. So keep your finger here and turn over to Isaiah 65. We're going to start in verse 17. Now, we read all of this before, but I'm just going to read a couple of verses here. But I just want you to notice the concepts in kind of the order of how it's laid out here. In verse 17, we have our reference to new heaven, new earth. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered or come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I create, for behold, I create Jerusalem as rejoicing and in her people a joy. And notice we're going to see here in verse 18 and 19, joy and weeping and crying being eliminated. In verse 19, I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people. The voice of weeping shall no longer be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. And notice we have, you know, weeping and crying being removed. We have new heaven, new earth, and then weeping and crying being taken away. And the next verse is going to talk about extremely long lifespans. In verse 20, in fact, I read this to you out of the New King James earlier. Let me read this to you out of the New Living Translation. I think it's a little clearer. And this is Isaiah 65 and verse 20 out of the New Living Translation. No longer will babies die when only a few days old. No longer will adults die before they have lived a full life. No longer will people be considered old at 100. Only the cursed will die that young. Now again, if you look at a number of translations, you can find lots of nuances on that particular verse. But let's just say, if we take this verse for what it says, what it suggests in the NLT is that you've got a picture where as long as people are being obedient to God, you know, and they're not just being rebels, they're going to have a very long lifespans, like, you know, hundreds of years, you know, through all this. They're going to live centuries. Now, I mean, it does say if you die shorter, you could be accursed. We covered earlier in Zechariah 14, you've got people that are just going to go, no, I ain't coming to the feast. I'm just not doing it. You know, I'm just going to be a hardhead. Well, I'm sure God's going to have a point where if people are just rebellious enough, he's had enough of them. You know, but again, this suggests very long lifespans, you know, of people during the millennium as long as they're obeying God. So what do we have? We have a reference to new heaven and new earth, weeping and crying going away, very long lifespans of people. In other words, death as we know it is, you know, you're 70, and if you get much more than that, then you're lucky, and then we all die, because that's kind of the normal course of events. That's not the norm anymore. It's the exception. Now consider the order of events in Revelation 21. Now, in Revelation 21, verse 1, what do we start off with? Reference to new heaven and new earth. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. And also there was no more sea. And again, I would suggest that's no more Satan's domain. And again, we've got the tabernacle of God with men, but if you jump down to verse 4, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, sorrow, or crying, and there shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. So you've got new heaven and new earth, weeping and crying going away, and a reference to not death. Again, I'll suggest I'm not going to give you a dogmatic interpretation of this. I'll say there's maybe two ways to look at this. One is either, again, a forward reference to saying, well, that's the ultimate objective, is that, you know, death will be done away with. But again, you could also look at that from a standpoint of this matching exactly Isaiah 65, because you have the reference of new heaven and new earth, and again, the same concepts following, painting the exact same picture. You know, again, you can decide which way you want to look at that, but I would suggest that Revelation 21 is the exact same reference as Isaiah 65, Isaiah 66, and 2 Peter 3. That new heaven and new earth is the replenished earth that we'll, you know, experience at the beginning of the millennium, where God heals it from all the devastation of the day of the Lord, and you have this Garden of Eden utopian setting. So, brethren, as we go forward throughout the rest of this Feast of Tabernacles, looking forward to the wonderful time that we have, hopefully we can glean from these scriptures and look forward with a great anticipation to a new heaven and new earth in which righteousness dwells.